Hi, everybody. It's Derek, and this is Foreign Exchanges, the podcast. Hello, hello, hello. Thanks to all of you for listening to the show. We're back again with one of my irregularly scheduled interviews. It's always a pleasure to get to do one of these. I wish I had time to do them more often, but this one was a particular pleasure, I have to say. I'm going to be joined in a moment here by Kenneth Harl, who's Professor Emeritus of Classical and Byzantine History at Tulane University. He is the author of a large number of courses. If you're into the Teaching Company and the Great Courses series, I am obsessed with these things. He's taught, I think, 13 of them. I think that was the number I saw on the website. I've listened to a bunch of them, so I'm a fan of his work. He does he's really good at the kind of engaging people in that format. So I was already a fan, and then I saw that he had written a book based on one of those courses. The book is called Empires of the Steppes: A History of the Nomadic Tribes Who Shaped Civilization, and we'll be talking about that book. I will have a link to purchase it in the show description, but definitely check that out. It's a really interesting book on a fascinating topic, and an incredibly expansive topic. We'll get into that in the interview, but it's shocking. I guess not shocking, but it's really amazing. Just the breadth of the book, geographically, chronologically, even, you know, in subjects like languages and religions, the amount of ground that's covered here is just amazing. So definitely check the book out. If you are new to Foreign Exchanges, you haven't visited the site before or checked out the newsletter, please do that. It's at www.foreignexchanges.news. It is a newsletter, first and foremost, that covers international affairs. I do these interviews when I have the chance, that I try to keep them devoid of any contemporary news, because I do so much of that for the newsletter. And so this one, we're gonna stick to, I think, ancient and medieval, sort of pre-modern times, which I always enjoy doing. And again, the topic is just something I've always been interested in. So really, I think you're going to enjoy the interview. He's a great storyteller, very engaging. So let's get to it. Hello, listeners. It's Derek. And as I said in my introduction, I am very pleased and grateful to welcome to the show Professor Kenneth Harl of Tulane University. He is the author of, I think I checked the site, 13 courses for the Teaching Company. Is that right? And also author of the book that we're going to be talking about today, Empire of the Steppes: A History of the Nomadic Tribes Who Shaped Civilization. Professor Harl, thank you so much for coming on the program. It's a great honor for me.
Well, I'm very pleased to talk to you. And, you know, professors are all frustrated stand-up comedians, so they love to have their captive audiences.
It's an open mic night here on Foreign Exchanges.
Yeah. I'm glad to talk about history. It's the trouble with an academic such as myself is if you ask them the time of day, they'll give you a lecture on the origin and development of the calendar. I mean, the problem is not getting us to speak, it's getting us to shut up very often.
Well, that's good, because people need to hear somebody else. Everybody who subscribes to this podcast hears me all the time. So it's nice for them to hear a different voice, I think. So I wanted to start first, before we get in, we're going to take sort of the roundabout way to get into the book, but I wanted to talk first about a little bit about your history, your career, and how you got involved with the Teaching Company and came to do a number of courses for them. If you could just sort of give people a sense of how that that process works.
Well, I should preface with the fact that I always wanted to be a professor of history, probably since about age six. And my entire life was devoted to studying the distant past. I'm terribly interested in modern history, you know, the 20th century, its ramifications today. But professionally, I've always looked to the past. And I was teaching at Tulane when an agent of the teaching company showed up and introduced herself. And she had reports on me based on different types of student evaluations of teachers. And she listened to two of my classes in my Roman Empire course. And then they invited me to go there and record a demonstration. And this is some time ago now. I think I still had some hair that wasn't gray then, if I recall correctly. And they then awarded me a course on Byzantine history because they couldn't find anyone who would be able to teach it. Byzantine history is seldom taught in American universities. And I'm sad to say that my university has not seen fit to replace my position. And so ancient and Byzantine history is not being taught right now at Tulane. I don't know if that was a business decision or not, but it's what got me the first recording. And then I started to record other courses. And on several occasions, they approached me with an idea. And that was particularly true of the course I did on the nomadic peoples for the teaching company. That came some 10 years later when they had reports from customers that they'd like to hear a course on the Silk Road. There were some vague questions about the Mongols. And I sat down and sketched out that course with the teaching company and recorded it. And then later still, about 10 years later, I was approached by a book agent about turning it into a popular book. And by then, I had changed my opinions. I'd been reading more widely on the subject for various reasons. And then I agreed to do the book. So this is all punctuated with my academic career, where I published scholarly works, which are for a much more limited audience. They're for people who are specialists in the Roman Empire or Greek history and early Byzantine history. And I wrote the book in part during the COVID lockdown. I wasn't going anywhere. I happened to be on sabbatical leave when COVID erupted, and I canceled my plans. I was going to go to Australia to work at their numismatic center, and that was just not possible. And so I did a fair amount of work on the book during the COVID lockdown. And during the year, I taught remotely because of COVID. I did not go into the classroom, given my age. And I then decided, after completing this work, to retire. I had taught for 43 years on all sorts of classes, and I think it was a wise decision for a number of reasons, but I do admit, I must admit, I miss the classroom. I always enjoy teaching more than anything else about the career.
I wonder how many people could tell that story, like COVID hit and I wrote a book. I wonder how many stories like that there are out there.
There must be quite a few, I would think.
That seems like a natural thing to do, sitting stuck at home, write a book. So you talked a little bit about the origins of the series, the Steppe Nomad series, and the decision to turn it into a book. Can you talk a little bit more about how you adapted? You mentioned some of your, views had changed, some of your opinions had changed. What were some of the major changes that you made in adapting the course into the book?
Well, moving into the book, I came to appreciate how adaptable the nomads were. And I also came to appreciate the difficulty of writing a narrative. The number of sources are quite limited. The nomads themselves seldom talk to us directly. We do have some such sources. I think overall, if I were to give one of the greatest revelations, it's my appreciation of the Khazars, the Uyghurs, the Kushans, people who are seldom known by the general public, who did remarkable jobs in state building. And the first two in that group actually on the steppes constructed very successful empires based on trade, international trade, employed scribes. And in the case of the Khazars, they embraced Judaism sometime at the late 8th century, and the Uyghurs, reportedly in 762 on the order of their Khan, Tengrin Boyu, converted to the Manichaean faith, which is a little-known faith of the religions of Abraham, as I would put it. The Kushans built their empire in northern India and were extremely important for the promotion of the Silk Road and Buddhism, which reached East Asia because of their success in implementing the peace along the Silk Road and promoting Buddhism within northern India and in Central Asia. And then as for individuals, I came away with an enormous admiration for Kublai Khan. And there I was inclined to think that based on reading Marco Polo as a young boy and then revisiting the text to write the book. But second is the fact that in studying Chinese history through the nomadic eyes, I realized how often China was fragmented and how often nomads were able to master northern China and create this peculiar provincial North Chinese civilization, which was part nomadic and part Chinese. But none of the steppe conquerors could ever conceive of overthrowing and conquering the entire of the Middle Kingdom. And Kublai Khan did it. Now, granted, he created a Chinese army and launched a fleet on the Yangtze and employed many of the Song generals, but he pulled off one of the most amazing military feats, in some ways more impressive than his grandfather, Genghis Khan. And second, no one really cares to think of him as their progenitor, their hero. I mean, you go to Mongolia, you got statues of Genghis Khan everywhere. Attila the Hun is claimed by the Hungarians and the Turks both, which is very peculiar given their history in the Balkans. and Tamerlane, well, he's deliberately suppressed by the Soviets and even the Russians now because he gives all those people in Central Asia too much of a notion of independence, which we certainly don't want that in Moscow.
No, you can't have that, absolutely.
But Kublai Khan is remembered by the Chinese as an outside invader who, you know, conquered the Middle Kingdom, and the Mandarins were really resentful. They had to work with this guy and listen to Mongol music at dinners, and you know they certainly didn't know what to do with yogurt drinks. And so he's also more or less forgotten by the Mongols because he's seen as a Sinified Mongol ruler. And yet he conducted or carried out the unification of China, which one wonders whether that would have happened if there had not been the Mongol conquest. A good deal of Chinese history is a history of division. The myth and the notion of a unified China and that China is the center of the world, you know, this goes back to the novel, The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, in which Chinese constantly quote it, that the longing for unity is natural. The need to recreate the motherland is just inherent in the Chinese, and yet the historical record is often at odds with that. And Kublai Khan did carry out the unification of China for the first time in over 400 years. And that's an achievement often forgotten. And he's much better remembered in the Western tradition because of Marco Polo, and then, you know, you get Coleridge's poem and Edgar Allan Poe and Citizen Kane, Xanadu, you know, the images of the Great Palace. And in rethinking Kublai Khan, I came away with an entirely different impression of him when I did the book as opposed to recording the course years earlier. And that's always a feature of being a professional historian is you're constantly changing your opinion about issues, or you're seeing it from a different light. And it's always good to remember that I always used to say in teaching, you're only as good as your last lecture. You know, you have to rethink it. You have to read over it. And sometimes my wife is curious. She sees me reading a work like, why are you reading it again? You know, you read it once.
Move on, man. Yeah.
You know, right now I reread Apuleius's Golden Ass, which is a great novel of the Roman world, written by a Roman citizen from North Africa who's a brilliant stylist. And it's the story of an individual who's the hero is all caught up on magic and by accident is turned into a and Ash and has all these misadventures and all. But it's just a wonderful insight into the social life of the Roman Empire. And you have to reread texts just to get a feel of them. And Roman history being my field of or my passion, to be more accurate, you go back and revisit works. And that's just natural, I think. If you have that yearning to learn, to want to know why, the Greek word is pothos, and it's a attribute of Alexander the Great. And it's Alexander wanted to know, not only conquer the world, but he also wanted to know about his world. So that's why his expedition was essentially filled with savants and scientists and all sorts of scholars who recorded what they saw. And that's how I got involved in the book, and that's how it's altered or sharpened my perceptions. It was a daunting task to simply record the course. I think I wrote 4 different versions on how to do the lectures before I decided on
it. Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And then I did changes and rewrites and cut out some things and added others when I did the book. You have to really pick and choose.
I have to say, I mean, even from the course for me, and then, you know, it's more apparent in the book, but even from the course, I came away with a better appreciation for Kublai Khan, because when I studied the Mongols, it was in the context of Islamic history. So it was from the West, and we learned right. about Hulagu and the Golden Horde, and less about what was going on in the East. But when you study them, and I'm getting like way ahead of ourselves here, but when you study the conquests, every place that they get stopped, Central Europe, in, you know, in Egypt or in the Levant, in India, it's always because they run into some geographic or environmental or some, you know, insurmountable obstacle. And it's only Kublai Khan in southern China who basically remakes the Mongol army to you know, recast it to conquer this place that they really, on their like sort of innate capabilities, probably shouldn't have been able to conquer. It's very impressive to think about it that way.
Well, that's a very astute observation, because you are absolutely correct in the case of India, let's say the Middle East or the Near East, and Central Europe, where essentially they outrun their logistical line of communications. For the Middle East, they're going to need the Venetian fleet if they're going to invade Egypt, and that was beyond them. And in the case of Central Europe, maybe they could have put the resources into conquering Central Europe, but why do it when you have China as the prize? Really, if there was any kind of decision making, and the Mongols had a better sense of geography than anyone else among their contemporaries, because of their position in Central Asia, their contact with merchants of all sorts, they really could balance out the difference between, do we really want to go into Central Europe, or would we rather conquer the Yangtze and all the silk farms and right? And there's just no question China was by far a greater prize. And I give them credit for that. But yeah, there are serious logistical issues. To conquer Central Europe, they would have had to raise an enormous infantry army. They would have had to bring in all of their engineers to take masonry castles. They could have done that, but at a considerable cost, and at what profit? If I were advising Batu.
Better use of resources for sure.
With all your enemies scheming.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And it's not even, you know, the back door is
also
wide open
for
all these other Khanates. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So to get into sort of the book at the basic level, even just to peruse the table of contents, it's apparent just how massive this topic is. And I wonder if you could give people a sense of the kind of ground or the extent of the ground that you have to cover geographically, chronologically, linguistically, and all these different facets, just how much there is to digest to try and tackle this topic as a unified thing. I remember, again, you know, when we would talk about just the Mongols in grad school, every book that you picked up was, you know, in the introduction, there would be, it seemed like there would be some little paragraph where the author would say, by the way, I only know Persian and not Chinese, so I'm sorry, but this isn't going to, I'm not going to cover the, you know, the Yuan dynasty that extensively. Or, you know, there was some, because you had to, you know, to do the whole thing, it was just a monumental undertaking. And you're doing, you know, not just the Mongols, but the whole sweep of steppe history. So talk about that.
Well, either I was very brave or very foolish. I'm actually paraphrasing Stephen Runciman in The History of the Crusade. In any case, I'm a classical historian trained in Western European languages, Greek and Latin. I did have training in comparative Indo-European linguistics. But when it comes to Chinese and Arabic, particularly, those are important languages for original sources, Iranian, I'm depending on other scholars in that area. But the problem with the topic is there's probably no one individual who will have all the languages in order to write this general history. So either you stay away from it or you plunge into it, knowing that you stand on the shoulders of a lot of people who are likely smarter than you are. But what you're trying to do is to prevent a general vision of what happened, and whatever the errors and mistakes, if that vision at least conveys the importance of these peoples and how they're all connected over 45 centuries, and that's what you're proposing to look at, then you would have achieved a good result. It would be worth it. And hopefully others will follow up. The problem is, as you said, with sources, you had to deal with linguistic evidence, particularly in the earlier stages, talking about the movement of Indo-European-speaking nomadic peoples. Depends very heavily on Indo-European linguistics, which is probably one of the most developed and sophisticated fields in historical linguistics, because that's what Europeans started on. They were essentially finding out the origin of the European languages, and then they were shocked to discover that Sanskrit is related to Latin and Greek. And that's in the establishment of the schools in by Jones, under the guidance of Warren Hastings, the Governor General of India, set that whole study in motion over 300 years ago. You're also dealing with archaeology and breakthroughs in DNA evidence. This is changing constantly in articles. Within 20 years, there will be more information about DNA connections that we're not aware of. And hopefully it'll be extended to later periods. But a lot of it has been concentrated in the earlier period that was involved in writing on the Tarim Basin mummies, Victor Mayer's work on indicating that the human physical remains indicate that you had a population in what is now the Turkish-speaking Uyghur province of China, which is half Chinese and half Turkic, as a result of Beijing's policies, that the original inhabitants spoke languages we dub Tokharian. They were also an admixture of Iranian peoples that moved in there. And so they are neither Uyghur nor Chinese, but something else. That's very controversial evidence, but again, dependent very heavily on historical DNA analysis and archaeology, and then linguistics, because Tokharian was identified as an Indo-European language. Presumably, the language of the people who originally arrived there, perhaps at the end of the 4th millennium BC. And again, that's a surmise that's plausible. It can't be 100% proof. You're also dealing with what the victims and foes of the nomadic peoples wrote. And that often has to be filtered through prejudices. And yet I was very impressed. This is where it was very helpful for my own work in the Roman Empire. Reading the inscription of Bilye Khan, the Khan who reestablished the Turkic Empire on the eastern steppes, overthrew the Chinese hegemony imposed by the Emperor Taizong in the mid-7th century. His memorial inscription tells us a great deal about how the Turks saw themselves, how they were wary of Chinese ways. And then you have the secret history of the Mongols, which again is a redaction in Chinese of a Mongol original that goes back to oral legends and epics, but it has to be plausible. When you take those two sources, those two written sources, which are very precious because they come from nomadic peoples themselves, whether directly or indirectly, and compare them to accounts of the literate civilizations, Herodotus for the Greeks, Ammianus for the Romans, Ibn Fadlan for the Arabic world, whose account inspired that movie, The 13th Warrior, which is a very pretty movie, but very strange.
Takes some liberties. Yeah,
it does. And according, I think Michael Crichton said he wrote it on a dare that he was going to make Beowulf interesting.
Mission
Neanderthals just for the heck of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoyed the novel and the movie both, but then I'm a sucker for epic spectacle. And that was one of the reasons I got into ancient history. I would often tell my students that I was born in 1951, and that was at the height, you know, at the Hollywood spectacles with Hercules movies and Greek legends and old, you know, Spartacus. And I was going to be a movie producer, make millions, live on the Riviera. And then they released Cleopatra, and that was a total bomb. And the biblical epic spectacle disappeared, and I had to become an underpaid professor of classical history. And my students actually believe this. And I've actually had some of them come up to me and ask me, well, what's it like breaking into Hollywood? And I said, look, that was all a joke, guys. They're very earnest and delightful.
Impressionable. And impressionable.
They're very literal-minded the way a young child can be. So in any event, on that digression, it allowed me to evaluate these sources, particularly classical sources. And Herodotus and Ammianus Marcellinus came off pretty well in that. They are trying to report information from firsthand accounts or people who had dealings with these nomadic peoples, particularly Herodotus. And so many of the comments in Ammianus Marcellinus, well, some of those warnings, like, don't go into buildings. The Huns don't like going into buildings. It blocks out the sky. Well, Billy Khan is saying, don't build Chinese-style cities. Stay on the steps. Don't lose your martial valor. That's how we got subjected to the Chinese in the first place. Also, all members of the family need to cooperate. And this was remarkable because he and his brother cooperated very closely in reconstructing the Second Turkish Khanate. And all of these nomadic confederations always risked a breakup in the second or third generation because of the rules of succession. So you go back and read the accounts of people from the urban literate civilizations, and some of these observers are on target. Of course, they will express prejudices. Herodotus is absolutely convinced, you know, only Greeks live in a polis, what we would translate as a city-state, and by the rule of law, no one else does. On the other hand, look at all the interesting customs of the Scythians and the value of them. And he gives us two incidents of Scythian rulers who became too enamored with Greek ways, who were unceremoniously deposed or executed. And again, the words of that Turkish Khan echo later that don't adopt Chinese ways, foreign ways. It's fine to trade with them. We need to trade with them. We need the foodstuffs to support us. But retain your traditions, your customs, your martial ethos if you want to remain free. And so you could do comparisons and come to appreciate and have more confidence in what you were writing about because you expanded outside of your immediate field. I came away in general with a far greater appreciation for these peoples. Usually, having written a lot on Roman frontier history, you're always looking at the Germanic peoples or the Parthians or the Persians from the Roman viewpoint. And well, how do we scheme to have them fight among each other? You know, Tacitus famous comment, well, if the gods don't grant that our enemies love us, at least they ensure that they hate each other, which is the greatest benefit the gods can give us as we go on our way, our imperial destiny. And yet, there's every indication that the nomadic peoples themselves could exploit the weaknesses in the urban civilization and were no fools when it came to dealing with diplomats sent by the great kingdoms. The one that comes to mind, it may have been Isteme who said it. We're not quite sure, but a Byzantine envoy shows up and the Turkish Khan just looks at the guy and says, oh, the Roman who speaks the 10 languages and the one lie. He's here to negotiate a treaty from the mad Emperor Justin II. He has no doubts of what's going. And or the Sung court that decided to get rid of the so-called Liao dynasty, the Khitans, by inviting the Jurgens to invade. And then the Jurgens proved to be a far more dangerous foe than the Khitans ever were. You know, be careful for what you wish. Same case with King Khusru and the Heftalites. He calls in the Turks to destroy the Heftalites, and he now has Turks in Central Asia, which are far more formidable than his previous neighbors. They are very adept at that. Attila and Genghis Khan, both setting up corps of engineers, in the case of Attila, people from the Roman Empire, in the case of Genghis Khan, Chinese, later Iranians, and they can capture cities, walled cities, which barbarians are not supposed to do. The usual stories that come from some of our accounts is that they see a locked gate and the barbarians have an emotional problem and go away. You know, they can't take the city. There's some really hilarious anecdotes that come down from 3rd century Roman historian Dexippus about the Gothic ineptitude of trying to capture cities. And again, in the 6th century, Procopius records with the sieges in Italy. The one that's best is during the first siege of Rome, if I can digress, the Goths build a storming tower to take the city of Rome again. And the Byzantine Roman garrison is absolutely stunned. The Goths built a tower and it's moving in our direction. What do we do? What do we do? And General Belisarius gets up there and looks at it and laughs hysterically because the tower is being pulled by a group of oxen. So he takes a bow and arrow and shoots one of the oxen. And the soldiers get the message.
That'll take care of it. Yeah.
And they start shooting. And then, of course, the tower stops. And the Goths don't know what to do. Well, that was not a problem with Attila or Genghis Khan. They were able to capture city. And, of course, Kublai Khan the same, as you mentioned earlier. Logistically and militarily, built an army with siege craft and launched a river flotilla to take the cities of southern China. So the adaptability of these people and the learning curve is extremely steep, and they can be easily underestimated because they don't leave writing. That's always a problem, and you have to depend on anthropologists who've lived with modern nomads and their observations, archaeology, going through the sources, historical linguistics. It's a daunting task, and in some areas, you're bound to make mistakes or overlook information because you're trying to bring a general picture. But at least I try. And as one of my dearly departed mentor, professors told me as an earnest freshman, he said, you know what scholarship is? It's taking an idea, running it to its logical conclusion, and then you sit back and find out where you made a fool of yourself.
Let everybody else come in and tell you what you got wrong.
That's you can't take yourself seriously. I take my subject very seriously, but I never took myself seriously. I actually had a lot of fun doing this.
Excellent. So I don't want to get too deep into any one particular group because that's a whole interview in itself. But maybe we could talk about some of the big overarching ideas in the book. And I thought maybe in particularly we could focus on the ways in which steppe peoples interacted with the settled societies around them. And there's a couple of different directions we can go. Obviously, the military direction is one, and we can get to that. But maybe we could start with sort of the less hostile aspects, the trade, the communication. When you talk about the tribes shaping civilization, as you do in the book, they're really the sinew that sort of binds these Eurasian settled societies together. So maybe we could start there with just some of the ways that they allowed for interaction between the nomads and the settled societies, and between the settled societies themselves.
I liked your image there. I wish I had thought of it myself. It's well put. And really, the Silk Road is impossible without the participation and cooperation of nomadic peoples. And that allowed, probably from the 3rd century BC, 4th century BC, and even today, the Belt and Road Initiative, China is trying to, in some ways, reinitiate that Chinese influence in all those republics in Central Asia that were once part of the Soviet Union. You couldn't do it without them. They were able to provide the guides, the escorts. You also had to calculate how to trade with these people on your way to the markets to the east or the markets to the west. So you had to stock up on trade goods and various items to give as gifts or to swap with the different nomadic peoples you would encounter. And this would be particularly true when you left the cities, which in medieval times would be Bukhara and Samarkand, and proposed to cross the great mountain ranges into the Tarim Basin and head for the Jade Gate, and ultimately to China, where the silk is going to be found. There, the nomads are absolutely essential. And it was on that trip, Marco Polo, along with his uncle and his father, took time in the Tarim Basin, probably to master enough Mongol language that he could present himself plausibly at the court of Kublai Khan, because there's constant interaction in those cities between nomadic peoples who are settling there, trading there. Furthermore, the nomadic peoples offered horses, which were essential. The Turks got their start by breeding a hybrid camel that was ideal for the trade. Bullitt's work on that study is very, very important, even if you disagree with some of his conclusions about how the climate had changed. And that's debatable, but there's no doubt that his main thesis holds up very well. And all of this would not be possible without the nomadic people. So they made the Silk Road possible. Furthermore, that allowed for the exchange of religions, ideas, material goods that would otherwise not have occurred. I don't know how Buddhism would have entered China had it not followed the Silk Road, and had arrived, carried by merchants, complements of those nomadic peoples, which impressed many Chinese. Well, Buddhism must be a very, very successful faith. Look at the success of their believers. It allowed for Manichaeism, Nestorian Christianity, and in a remarkable instance, Judaism, to be adopted by a Turk people. And these conversions resonate today. The conversion of the Turkish peoples to Islam is one of the great important religious changes in human history, because the Turks are going to prove to be an absolutely essential people for the expansion of Islamic civilization in the later Middle Ages and the modern age. And the Turks are overwhelmingly linked with an Islamic religion, which has been adapted to Turkish traditions going back to the steppes. Most Turks in the modern Republic of Turkey, where I spent a lot of time, and as I may have indicated in the dedication, my wife is Turkish, so I always felt a certain kinship writing about the Turks. By extension, the Mongols, and they today, even though the vast majority of them, if you do the DNA, are descended from people of the Balkans and Anatolia who've been there for millennia, nonetheless, look to that Turkish heritage from Central Asia, which shaped their civilization and created a new civilization in the Mediterranean world, which is partially nomadic. And no one can dispute the importance of the Ottoman Empire. That is the last great, in some ways, renaissance of Islamic civilization, and its breakup in the 20th century is the reason for the geopolitical mess we have today, without making any statements one way or the other, but that's just a historical fact. So the economic role, the communications between the civilizations, and at times, you know, at the beginning of the book, there it's tantalizingly limited. There's very little direct contact between China and Rome, because the Roman merchants traveled to Marakanda, which is the predecessor of Samarkand. They get their silk there, but it's the Sogdians who then cross over into China. And there's no, you know, there's reports of contacts. A couple of missions are sent out, but they never reach the Roman Empire. The envoy sent out by Ban Chao, Chinese military governor of the Western regions, never reaches the Mediterranean. Apparently, he turns back. And so they have just a vague notion of what China is, and the Romans know of the Seres who make silk. But later on, you get the reports, and I loved writing the chapter by the papal envoys and Marco Polo, who travel and actually start bringing back direct information to Europe. That's impossible without the Mongol peace and the promotion of the Silk Road by the Mongols. It would never have had that exchange. Of course, one of the dubious products that goes across that route is gunpowder, which the Europeans get a hold of.
We'll get into that. I think,
going the best, and then the game plan changes. Of course, you have, you know, block printing and paper and all sorts of medicinal goods and mathematics and astronomy that's being transmitted between the Islamic world and China. But it's that gunpowder that proves to be the nemesis.
Yeah, funny how that works. Yeah. We can't have this discussion without talking about the nomadic way of war and the military interactions. And I got the sense from the book and from the lecture course, you could imagine people living in the Roman Empire or the Persian Empire or China just kind of balling their fists up and complaining that these nomads cheat, basically. They don't fight fair. And like getting really frustrated with that. But can you talk about why the nomads had seemingly such a military advantage over settled societies, and how the big ones, China and Rome in particular, you know, dealt with that and were able to undertake somewhat successful, I guess, at least in a temporary sense, military campaigns against some of these groups?
Well, this goes back to one of your earlier observations when you talked about outrunning your logistical limits and geography and the barriers. It's the conditions living on the steppes. The grasslands provide the fodder for all of those animals they herd, which is the basis of their success, their sustenance. On the other hand, it is an extremely brutal climate in which weaklings don't survive. So the population is hardened by the very experience of daily living. They have to know how to move quickly to find water and grasslands. They could move great distances at a short notice based on seasons or a drought or a bitter winter that will force them to move. They're extremely pragmatic in negotiating what we would call easement, traveling over the grasslands and making use of water of another tribe. This would be cemented by different types of marriage contracts and other arrangements, guest friendships. So their ability to survive on those steppes also meant a great deal of hunting and scavenging for food. The papal envoy sent to the court of the great Khan Guyuk, Father Giovanni Carpini, list to his disgust all the types of foods the nomads would eat. Critters that no one would consider, you know, down to rats and all sorts of animals, because they have to survive. Well, this creates a warrior race that can travel great distances, can endure all sorts of hardships. Ammianus Marcellinus says, well, the Huns just live on their horses, and that's all there is to it. They you know, are essentially centaurs in the Greek mythological notion. And that meant that every free adult male knew how to use a composite bow and the edge weapons to melee. Because of their hunting skills, their traveling, they understand that they could be outnumbered, and they make the climate and the terrain work for themselves by ambush, by stealth, by rapid movement. The settled peoples always think they're more numerous than they are, because they can move so quickly, concentrate their forces at a critical point, and win an engagement, and then disappear into the steppes, to the frustration of a Chinese general or Roman general. Like, these guys don't fight fair. They disperse. They constantly scatter over. To make a crude analogy, it would be the reaction that George Armstrong Custer had about the Native Americans, the Dakota and the Sioux. They disappear. They won't fight, you know. And then, of course, well, we saw what got them at the Little Big Horn. They did decide to fight. You know, that was a Sioux victory of a really quite extraordinary extent. And that is because they're pragmatic. They understand the odds. And it reminds me of that wonderful movie that's adapted from the Kipling short story, The Man Who Would Be King, where I believe it's Sean Connery who's training the locals. He said, I'm now going to train you in that noble profession of soldiering, where you can stand up like a civilized man and kill your foe, which goes back to your original point. The only way to deal with them was to mount cavalry, to come up with formations of infantry and cavalry in close support, whether it's a Chinese general like Li Jing in the 7th century or Alexander the Great on the Jaxartes River. They all have to pursue very similar tactics if they want to prevent being ambushed or drawn into a long weeks campaign in which their men wear down, their horses get exhausted from lack of water and fodder, and then the nomads time their attack perfectly to panic the army and win the campaign. And so until the advent of firearms and field artillery, the nomadic cavalry are one of the most formidable forces in world military history. And clearly, Genghis Khan and I think Attila the Hun rank as really superb commanders strategically. If we had a account about Attila the way we have of Genghis Khan, I think you'd see a lot of similarities between the two men in their military thinking and ability. Organization of their forces, rewarding of vassal tribes, sponsoring engineers, diplomatically timing your attacks at the most advantageous moment. And in the case of the Huns, if you go to Istanbul, look at those walls, the Theodosian Wall. Those were built to keep the Huns out of the city. That's quite a testimony to what the threat must have represented. So militarily, they have that advantage. They don't have the financial resources to sustain the type of wars waged by urban-based civilizations where you're going to conquer your foe, you know, Roman expansion in the Mediterranean. That's very unusual. And again, Kublai Khan is the exception there. But they are able to defend their territories. And with the exception of the Emperor Taizong, who ruled in the early 7th century, no ruler of any urban civilization ever really conquered the steppes before the advent of firearms. It was beyond their capacity. They encountered a foe that had a number of advantages, and then their raiding or invasions into the borderlands of the sedentary empires proved a real challenge. In the case of the Han Empire, they had to completely rethink their military organization to deal with the Shuang Nu. I mean, it must have been an enormous economic change in putting your resources to the Han armies if you're going to wage that long war with the Shuang Nu, which was the decision of the Emperor Wu Di. And he ruled from 141 to 87 BC and initiated the long series of wars between China and the Shuang Nu. And in the end, they did defeat the Shuang Nu. They broke it up. But it also compromised the Han Empire, which also broke up. So it's one of those cases where both sides really didn't do so well.
There was no winner. Yeah. No winner of that one.
No. Pure victory along the way.
Exactly. This leads kind of naturally then into one of my two closing questions, which was how this frontier eventually closes down. And you've alluded to it a couple of times, the transmission of gunpowder and its adoption by the Europeans, the building of great sailing ships to go around this landmass by sea instead of trading through it. But what are the factors that eventually wind up bringing this very long period of steppe nomad, I don't want to say dominance, but very, you know, playing a very important role in the politics of Eurasia to a close?
Well, I think if you look at it geopolitically, what happened is the Ming emperors of China and the czars of Moscow ultimately came to partition these lands between their two great empires. In the case of the Chinese, the Ming emperors, this was the great native Buddhist revolution that expelled the Yuan dynasty, commissioned the Great Wall as we see it today, and were determined never again to allow those people to dominate the Middle Kingdom. In the case of the Russians, it goes back to Ivan the Terrible and the military reforms to build the Russian state and finally shake off the so-called Tartar yoke. And Moscow got its start by being the collection agency of the Golden Horde. That's its real start. This could get us into real trouble with geopolitical statements right now, especially between Kyiv and Moscow. in any case, those two imperial orders were determined to expand across the Eurasian landmass, and they had the means to do so. They had the finances and the weapons to do so. The development of the oceanic trade is extremely important. And ironically, that is another result of Marco Polo, because bringing back all this information of Cathay, which is a corruption of Kitan, which were people who had lived in northern China and becomes the European designation for North China in the 13th and 14th centuries, came up with the idea, well, if we sail west, we'll eventually hit the east and we'll get all those goods. We just didn't know there were these new continents in the way. But the development of oceanic trade from the 15th through the 18th century, which was confined to the northwestern European countries that could launch those ships and had the artillery on them, it's very, very hard to underestimate what that impact had on the Silk Road. It's stated by an Ottoman scholar, for instance, is why is it the Europeans can travel by sea to India and get all the wealth, and we can't do it, even though we're fairly close? Of course, we have Safavid Iran in the way, but they are taking the riches on the ships and bringing it back to themselves when we should be able to have access to it. And that observation in the 16th century captures very much what's happening in the global economy. A new global economy is being constructed. And that became very clear last year when my wife and I were down in Panama and saw the Panama Canal. The Panama Canal and the Suez Canal are two of the big achievements in the modern age to make sure that international oceanic trade continues. And Anyone who's traveled across the Pacific and seen the extensive trade in the Pacific between Asia, Australia, the Americas, gets to realize that immediately. So when you also have to remember that the destructive wars of Tamerlane did a great deal of damage to those caravan cities. Now, Samarkand certainly prospered, but many other cities suffered grievous sacks. And that helped contribute, and I wouldn't call it a primary cause, but it was one cause, because with the death of Tamerlane in 1405, you're on the eve of that gunpowder revolution. The new Muslim states that emerge are the Ottoman Empire, Safavid, Iran, and Mughal India, all urban-based and all based on the military revolution and gunpowder. Europeans don't like to think about that, but in the 16th century, all three of those states were in the forefront of military technology. It'll change in the 17th century, but in the 16th century, definitely so. And they do a good deal in bringing the nomads to heel, incorporating them as allies. The heirs of the Golden Horde end up being the vassals of the Ottoman Emperor, the Ottoman Sultan in Constantinople. The Iranians have the same goal with the Uzbeks. The Mughals look to Central Asia to bring in warriors as mercenaries and soldiers to maintain their control of India and import Persians as their administrative class. So a number of factors, the emergence of the Islamic gunpowder empires, the expansion of China and Russia across the steppes and Siberia, the development of the oceanic trade, gradually leads to the diminishing of the importance of the nomads. They become vassals of great bureaucratic empires. The trade continues, but it loses its importance because of the emergence of new trade routes, new goods. Their prominence as the sinews of civilization wanes. It's still there. And there are efforts to retap it and exploit it. And I think of Beijing's current policy of the Belt and Road Initiative as being one of those. But the world has changed. So that's a long-winded explanation of why that passing took place about 500 years ago. What's remarkable is their impact still endures. The fact that male run around wearing trousers is one of them. Those are devised to ride horses. The Romans and Greeks, you know, one of the telltale signs of being a barbarian in the later Roman world is you're wearing trousers and you've got a belt. If I can be so facetious.
So that's, I mean, I think that's maybe the a good way to end, just to sort of, you could talk a little bit about the legacy in big terms of these nomadic peoples and the ways that they did shape civilization. I mean, obviously we've been, you know, kind of going through them in the course of the interview, but as you're sort of summing up, what was your takeaway from having studied all these groups?
Well, they're so important for the dissemination of and some of the most important world religions that are on the globe today. They made it possible for pious missionaries and merchants who were firmly convinced, Muslims, Christians, whatever, to carry these faiths across the Eurasian landmass. And the Roman Empire gets a lot of credit for that. Without the Roman roads and the Roman peace, would Christianity have spread? Well, you could say very much the same thing without the nomads and the great confederations, the Mongols, the Kushans, all of these. Would Buddhism, would Islam, would the Church of the East, as they call themselves, would they have spread and had the influence that they did? You know, Buddhism reaches Japan. All the Han peoples have been profoundly influenced by Buddhist teachings, and that's complements of the Silk Road, which is complements of the nomadic people. The exchange of ideas and information that revolutionized warfare. they did it deliberately by inventing chariots, the light chariot, and then the mounted warrior, the horse archer. But they also were responsible for the gunpowder revolution, which has changed warfare. And you get into, you know, the works of McNeil on the pursuit of power and all the military historians talking about how strategy has been profoundly changed by this. The economic ramifications, the movement of peoples and ideas across the steppes, the introduction of papermaking, the idea of paper money, which was taken from China and brought into Iran by Hulago and the Ilkhans. There's so much intellectual exchange that goes on that could not have happened without these nomadic peoples, and a widening understanding of what the physical world really is. The Europeans who went east in search of alliances or profit with the Mongols had their minds blown away because they inherited this vision of the world created by Cosmos Indicopleustes, one of the great nincompoops of history, as I would call him, because he's the idea of the flat earth with Jerusalem in the center, and you're going to reconcile Christian theology with geography and get this really warped version of what medieval Europeans apparently thought the world looked like. And then there's that Prester John out there, and they don't find him, and they realize the world is so much more vast than they could ever have imagined. I think of the awe of William of Rubeck, who was a missionary, misunderstood as an envoy from St. Louis, which actually helped him, going across the steppes and could not imagine the size of these rivers and grasslands because he came from Flanders. To him, the Seine River was a great river. And then he's crossing all of these great rivers on the South Russian steppes, and then the immense grasslands he crosses over to get to the Mongol court. The whole sense of geography, the whole sense of our understanding of the physical dimensions of the world, we owe a great deal to the nomads for that. And I always said this, I think when I recorded the course, and it was an observation that came to me very early, is if you look at the world from their viewpoint, which they're at the roof of the world, looking out at all the civilizations around them, they made it possible for this geographic knowledge to be disseminated. And that made possible the European voyages of discovery, which further transformed our notion of the world. And you think of how far we've come from the geography of antiquity to now. It's really extraordinary how humans have learned what their physical space really is about. Another point is, without the nomads, the horses probably would have gone extinct. They're the ones that domesticated it for winter food, and then eventually as a beast of burden, and then as a vehicle of war. And they bred those horses to create the modern horse that we have today. And horsepower has been an extremely important element in human civilization in Eurasia, and has certainly profoundly transformed the Americas when those critters got loose onto the Great Plains.
Yeah,
for sure. Or Mr. Custer learned that to his surprise. He encountered one of the greatest light cavalry forces of all time. So that's what I would put as the great picture there. And and you really have to sit back with admiration that they turned a climate that many of us would have found very inhospitable, like, oh my gosh, what am I doing here, into a highway, as well as a way of maintaining their own lives. And that's an extraordinary achievement. They get a great deal of credit just for the daily survival on that, and then being able to act, as you call it, the sinews of civilization.
I think that's the perfect place to end the book. Again, Empires of the Steppes, A History of the Nomadic Tribes Who Shaped Civilization. Everybody buy it. Go out. I don't even want to say check it out. Go buy it. It's a great book. And check out
Professor Harrell's work with the teaching company. If you're into those things, if you're as obsessed with them as I am, it's a great series. And again, Professor Harrell, thank you so much for coming on and talking to me.
Well, you've been very kind and considerate and allowed me to ramble on. So I appreciate it. No way.
That's I think that's what people need. They want to hear the other person ramble on, not me. So for a change. So I thank you for that.
Well, thank you again.
Okay, so that's all for us today. I want to thank once again Kenneth Harrell from Tulane University for sitting down with me to have that fascinating conversation. Really, check out the book. There's so much more in there that we could have talked about. I mean, he's done a whole lecture series on this, like hours of stuff. So there's lots of material that we obviously didn't get to in a one-hour interview. But the book, again, is Empires of the Steppes, A History of the Nomadic Tribes Who Shaped Civilization. I'll have a link to that in the show description, as well as a link to Professor Harrell's great courses page. Again, if you're into those sorts of things the way that I am, you'll want to check some of those out as well. Thanks to all of you for listening to the show. And again, if you haven't checked out Foreign Exchanges, please do. www.foreignexchangesalloneword.news, as in I'm going to check out the news, and maybe subscribe. You don't even have to pay anything. There's a free subscription you can grab and just check it out for a little while and see if you like it. So please do that. And again, thanks for listening. Until next time, take care, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.